Good evening, everybody. Shmuel Platzer coming at you live from Gulf Manor Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. And I apologize for being a few minutes late. It's 7:37, so let's begin. I'm sitting over here in our conference room, in our Shal Shittish room in Gulf Manor, kind of all to myself so I can keep you guys informed. I have to jack the phones, use the phone. That's what we're doing right now, and that's the way it is. So I'm a little bit at a distance from the class. I welcome everybody to tonight's class, and thank you all for being here tonight. We're going to continue our study of chapter 6 in 1 Kings. I don't know how to make this any more exciting than the author makes it. It's just not the, you know, it's kind of I don't know how to say this. I mean, a lot of numbers going on. But everybody feel free to jump in. And I'll do the best that I can to move the phone around, and we'll get going right now. So if you're with me, we're in 1 Kings and we're in chapter 6. We left off having finished verse 5 for the most part, and now let's get started with Pasuk Vav, verse 6. You know, just for the sake of completion, let me just catch us up. I'll just read to you from the very beginning of the chapter in English. It takes a minute. It was in the 480th year after the departure of the children of Israel from Egypt, in the fourth year, in the month Ziv, which is the second month of Shlomo's reign over Israel, that he began to build the house of God. Okay. Verse 2. And the house which King Shlomo built for God, the length was 60 cubits, the breadth thereof was 20 cubits, and the height was 30 cubits. Verse 3. And the porch before the temple of the house, 20 cubits was the length thereof, before the breadth of the house, and 10 cubits was the breadth thereof before the house. Verse 4. And he made for the house windows broad within and narrow without. And we spent some time on much of this last week, so please, if you can, make an effort to listen to the last week's class. Verse 5, and against the wall of the house he built a chamber round about, against the walls of the house round about, both of the temple and of the sanctuary, and he made chambers round about. A lot of the usage of the word saviv over there three times came up, and the word rachba is going to be coming up three times in our upcoming verse. So there's a lot. Rabbi Berlin said last week that there's maybe even a poetic way of looking at this. The author is poetically, repeating certain words for emphasis, and it's certainly likely. What else can explain the usage of that word three times in verse 5, different word three times in verse 6. Let's take a look at verse 6. Here we go. Pasuk Vav, Hayatzia Hatachtona Chamesh Ba'ama Rochba, Vahatichona Shesh Ba'ama Rochba, Vahashlishis Sheva Ba'ama Rochba. So that might be a decent enough place to unpack things. It's at the midpoint. The Hayatzia Hatachtona, the lowest, or the low part, the low chamber, Chamesh Ba'ama Rochba, it was 5 cubits broad. That was the nethermost. They wanted to translate it like that. The lowest or the nethermost chamber was 5 cubits broad, and v'hatichona, and the middle one, shesh ba'amar rachba, that was 6 cubits broad. V'ashlishis, and the third was sheva ba'amar rachba, 7 cubits broad. And the word tichona, don't we see a lot of that? Isn't the Mediterranean Sea the Yam HaTichon? Isn't that the I'm going to ask a question. Do we call the Yam HaTichon the Middle Sea because it's only because we now know that there's an Atlantic, which is this massive body of water, so we have to call the Mediterranean Sea the Middle Sea, and I guess maybe, I don't know, maybe is the Indian Ocean the other big body of water, and the Mediterranean is the middle one? If that's true, what did we call the Mediterranean Sea before we knew about the Atlantic Ocean? Is that a fair question to ask? Or is that a Meshuggah question to ask? I don't even know what I'm asking, but I'm asking, if they call it Yam HaTichon, does that mean the Middle Sea? And if it does, that therefore implies other seas surrounding it. When did we know, as a people, when did we know about the existences of those massive bodies of water, such that we would call the Mediterranean the middle one? Is that a reasonable question or not at all? What do you think, Mrs. Brewer? What do you got? I'm going to come to you. What do you say?
I'm thinking maybe because the Mediterranean is laterally, is in terms of its latitude, is more central as opposed to other oceans which extend to the north or south.
That's an interesting one.
Is the Mediterranean not surrounded by land on all sides?
Mediterranean is extends from like Israel all the way west, all the way to Spain.
Is it surrounded by land?
My
understanding is yes, and that is why it's called Yam HaTichon. It's the interior sea. It's not open right now. Now, by the time of Chazal, at least, okay, they knew of a world ocean. I don't think they had enough knowledge of world geography to know about the various oceans that we know and how they interact, but I think they knew that there was a grand ocean that was like over around everything. They call it Yam Okeanos. And then this is Yam HaTichon as opposed to Yam Okeanos.
Right.
Now, Tanakh, why do they call it the Sea? Just call it a Yam? I don't think it's attributed.
The Yam. Didn't Jonah go into the Yam, the sea, right? He was going to hit the road, he was going to hit the sea to go to wherever, Tarsus. So they were calling that, in the Tanakh times, they were calling the Mediterranean the Yam. That's my understanding. Did they know about, but there was no notion of an Okeanos necessarily in biblical times.
I don't know if we have any clear evidence of it. You know, you have to look at various references in Tanakh and decide what those words mean. You know, I'm not a bulky in that. I really am not.
Thank you very much. Let me just get some, there we go. Try to cool it down a little bit. Very good. Okay. So Gabriela's point about the Yam HaTichon, thank you also, Mrs. Brillo. The Yam HaTichon referring to the interior sea. It was a sea that was understood by everybody who sailed on it, that it went from the shore of Israel, it extended all the way, towards Egypt and then along North Africa, and it went up to Turkey, and then it went over to Greece, and then it went over to Rome, Italy, and it kept on going, and so there is that idea in the literature. So thank you very much. I was just curious as to how we came to call the Mediterranean the Yam HaTichon. At all events, we've got this nethermost chamber, 5 cubits, middle 1/6, and the third was 7. That's how broad, that's how wide these chambers were. And we're going to do some footnoting in a moment, but let me just finish off the pasuk if we can. Ki migraos nasan labayis saviv chutza levilti achos bekiros habayis. Ki migraos nasan labayis, because he made. Now the term that they give me over here in my English is rebatements. He made migraos rebatements, and the mitzvah says milashon garon. Now, I'm not sure if that's helping me out a whole lot, but let's just let it be at the moment, because I'm sure our footnotes, quoting our Mefarshim, will hopefully shed some light. Because he put these rebatements in the wall of the house, Nasan Labayis Saviv Chutza. He did it, he put these rebatements round about, Chutza on the outside, Levilti Achos Bekiros Habayis, so that the beams should not have hold, in the walls of the house. And I got to say, we're going to try to make some sense out of this if we can, but it's not narrative. I happen to feel better with the narrative. I feel more at home. But Mr. Brewer, if you have something to add, by all means, what do you got?
In some kind of like the windows that were narrow on one side and wide on the other side. The house, if you think about it, is like the opposite of a pyramid. It's getting wider and wider as it goes up.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe these are kind of some kind of supports to hold it.
Okay. Could very well be, right? Interesting. Thank you very much for that. Does anybody have a really good depiction of the first temple? Do we have to go to Midos? And would that enable us, would the Mishnayos in Midos enable us to draft up some sort of depiction of what Shlomo was putting up, is my question. Or is Midos all about the second temple, not the first one? It's only going to be about Hadrian's? Is it going to be Hadrian's temple? Okay, Ravilla thinks that when the Chazal talk about the temple in Mishnayos Midos, obviously, first century, second century, and Rebbe is collecting it and editing it in the year 200 or so of the Common Era, roughly, so when the rabbis talk about the temple, they had many of them. Obviously, the Tanaim had some intimate knowledge of it. They saw it up until its destruction at the end of the first century, in the year 70. So when they talk of the Beis HaMikdash in Mishnayos Midos, we can be pretty much sure that they're talking about, at least we feel, they're talking about the second temple. But I get the impression from some of my Mefarshim over here that Midos is also referencing the first temple. And if it's doing that, then that is a tricky thing, because that's talking about a temple 500 years before. So let's let the Mefarshim kind of play it out. Let's see what, if anything, the Judaica Press has to say in our Pasuk, and we'll talk it out. Here we go. Now, there's a lot here, so let's go ahead and check it. The nethermost temple, Hayetziah HaTachtona, the nethermost temple was 5 cubits broad. Welcome, Barry. Says the chamber, the nethermost chamber, thank you. Hayetziah HaTachtona, the nethermost chamber. He says, on each side, we can be quoting Rashi here, on each side of the temple, the chambers were built in 3 tiers, one on the other. And the measurement of its length is not stated here. The measurement of length is not here, only width. That's the only thing that we know about in this verse. We've got these chambers in the temple, 5 cubits broad on one, middle one is 6 cubits broad, third one was 7 cubits broad, and he made some rebatements in the wall all around the outside so that the beams should not have any hold in the walls of the house. Writes the Rabbi Rosenberg, nor is the length mentioned elsewhere in the Talmud. So we don't have any scriptural discussion about how long these chambers are within the temple, and we don't have it in the biblical scripture, we don't have it in the Talmud. We don't know necessarily how long they were, just how wide they were. Now, the Tiferes Yisrael, in describing the various sections of the temple, surmises that it was approximately 14 cubits long, except for the chambers on the western side. The two lower floors measured 7 cubits each, whereas the two chambers of the upper story measured 10 cubits each. And now Rashi continues, and we're going to read it in English. And in the tractate Midos, chapter 4, Mishnah 3, we learn as follows. There were 38 chambers in all, 15 in the north, 5 on top of 5, and 5 more on top of them. There you've got your 15 in the north. And the same number in the south. 15 plus 15 equals 30. And 8 more were in the west. And so 30 plus 8 gives you the 38 chambers. 3 on top of 3, and 2 more on top of them. Those were the 8 in the west. The nethermost chamber was 5 cubits wide and the middle ones were 6 cubits, and the top ones were 7. Why was this difference? Answers Rashi, for he made rebatements in the wall of the house, round about on the outside. The height of the chamber was 5 cubits. And as the height of the wall of the temple proper reached 5 cubits, he reduced its thickness and recessed it 1 cubit inward on the outside. And on that recess, he placed the ends of the bimas of the roof at the top of the chamber, which served as the floor of the middle one. Now, this is getting super architectural, is it not? I mean, I really do think that we need a draftsman here. And unluckily for us, I am not that guy. I cannot draft this. I'm not an architect, but I'm going to keep on reading. And if anybody has anything to add, go ahead and do it, and then we're going to keep moving on, because these are the measurements. They are what they are, and I can't seem to picture them any better than what I'm reading. And as the wall reached 10 cubits, he again recessed it 1 cubit in order to place the ends of the beams of the roof of the middle chamber, which served as the floor of the upper chamber. We thus find, all this is Rashi, and we're finishing off this Rashi, we thus find the middle one is broader than the lower one by 1 cubit. And the upper one is broader than the middle one by 1 cubit. And indeed, that's what the scripture itself said. The lowest one was 5 cubits broad, middle one 6, and the utmost top one was 7. Okay, we're going to keep going. They're going to quote now the Rabbeinu Yeshaya HaRishon. The inside of the wall was straight from the bottom to the very top. The inside of the wall was straight from the bottom to the very top. It was only on the outside that these recessions reduced the thickness of the walls every 5 cubits by 1 cubit. And as the Matsudas David, at the end of 15 cubits, the wall was again recessed to accommodate the beams which served as the roof for the third story chamber. If somebody would only put this on a diagram, on a paper, how grateful I would be. The Mishnah in Midos, this is chapter 4, Mishnah 7, states that the width of the chamber was 6 cubits, whereas the text states quite clearly that it measured only 5 cubits. So we've got something of a machlokes. Scripture over here said that the width of the chamber was 6, this text states quite clearly that the nethermost, most bottom chamber was 5 cubits broad or wide, and yet the Mishnah in Mito says that it was 6 cubits, as opposed to Scripture, which says 5. So how do we understand that difference? We find many opinions explaining this apparent contradiction, amongst them that of Tosfos in Yuma, Daf 52a, and also see Baba Basra, 61a, who suggests that the Mishnah refers to the second story chamber, which gained another cubit because of the recession of 1 cubit in the wall of the temple. It's amazing to me that people can even imagine, you know, just start putting this all together and keeping it all straight in their heads, because it's going to get even more technical soon. And we continue, quote, the beam should not have hold, so that the beam should not have hold in the walls of the house. Quoting Rashi, his intentions in making these rebatements was in order not to join the ends of the beams to the walls through perforations in the walls of the house. Since this causes the deterioration of the wall and is also not beautiful architecturally, so says Rashi. And now they're going to quote down a Radak and a Matsudas David. Others suggest another purpose in these rebatements. Since there was neither hammer nor axe, nor any tool of iron heard in the house, as stated in verse 7, it was therefore not possible to make the necessary perforations in the walls at the building site. Nor was it practical to cut these openings at the quarry. This explains also why reference to the lack of iron tools is made at this point, where the chambers and their entrances are described, quoting the Radak and the Metzudas David. So again, because there was no hammer or axe used as a tool and any kind of tool of iron in the house itself where they were working, therefore it wasn't possible to make any necessary holes in the walls at the building site because they had no iron utensils to do it. And it wasn't practical to cut those openings at the quarry. Okay. And that's why there's reference made to the lack of iron tools at this point. And they're going to bring in the shamir right now. Now we're going to be introduced, even though we saw it a couple of weeks ago, we're going to see a little bit more about the worm known as the shamir. That's going to come up here right now in verse 7, Pasuk Zion. Okay, this gives a whole other meaning to bagel and a shamir. Verse 7. I'll be here a week. V'habayis b'yibonoso even shlema masa nivna. The house, when it was in the building stage, was built of stone, finished at the quarry. The temple, when it was being built, the Hibonoso, when it was in the building stages, it was built of stone, was Eben Shlema Masa Nivna, built of stone, and it was completed, it was Shlema, it was completed at the quarry. Umakavos v'hagarzen kol kli varzel lo nishma babayis b'hibonoso. And there was neither hammer, nor axe, nor any tool of iron heard in the house while it was in a building stage. So had you gone to the temple while it was being put up, you would not have heard iron instrumentation working in the temple itself. There was no hammer, there was no axe, and there was no tool of iron being utilized within the temple as it was being put up on the actual place where the temple was. While it was being raised, you would not have seen or heard any iron utensils. So now let's get introduced to the shamir, this near miraculous worm. Take a look at my footnote. When it was in the building, you would not have, the house when it was in building was built of stone. It was built of stone, which was finished at the quarry. Okay? Exactly as it was removed from the mountain. Okay? It was finished at the quarry where they were digging out stone from the mountain. It was, according to this, it was completed over there. It was exactly as it was necessary. It was removed from the mountain. How was that happen? How did that happen? How did they get exact measurements done at the quarry, such that all they needed to do was just transport it. Who did the work at the quarry? And he says, through the worm, through the shamir worm, which cuts through stones. Of course, I think a question may have been raised some time ago. Okay, so at the temple, you wouldn't have heard any iron. Was that also necessarily true at the quarry? Were they also forbidden to have iron instruments at the quarry? If so, then okay, then it makes sense. You need a worm to do the work. But otherwise, if it's not necessary, if there's no prohibition about iron utensils, so then use them to your heart's content at the quarry. I get it that at the actual Harabayit, at the actual Temple Mount, you can't use iron. There you have to put the shamir into work. But why are they putting the shamir to work at the quarry? Did we come to a conclusion about that? Tyler, what do you have? What do you thoughts you have?
There is a technology that they have now It's like this, it's like a water hose, and it squirts out water at like 60,000 pounds per square inch, and it can cut through steel and stone, and anything you put under it, it slices it.
The water itself?
Yes. Would Rob Berlow, would it be within halakhic bounds to be able to cut these stones with such a device?
I don't know.
Hmm.
But it's water.
Yeah.
Powerful water.
Yeah.
So then we're
it's
thinking, you know, why
it goes. I'm not sure how deep it goes. But, yeah, they use those type of things. Usually it's metal around them and it uses the pressure. I don't think it would work at a quarry. It would work for finishing stone.
But not necessarily at a quarry.
I mean, it could work to a certain depth. So I don't know how far they. It'd be hard to do.
Well, I mean, you gotta think it's 60,000 pounds per square inch. Your normal my car probably only weighs like what 3 or 4 tons. We're talking about 60,000 pounds. That's a lot. That's like cars upon cars upon cars upon cars of pressure that is beating down on that rock, and it's able to bust it, and it's actually used for industrial projects. So I think it's very possible that can be done.
It's possible in the sense that you could take steel and you can put a whole bunch of metal in a piece, and you put two electrodes in, and instantly it's all melted. With today's technology, but this technology is have this equipment would be huge and difficult because you wouldn't have the machinery to even build it. So I'm not saying that you can't do some of that today, but I don't see it being done at a quarry. I could see it being done in a factory. It can't be done at a quarry.
Right here, look.
You'd have to bring it all in there.
Here's this video.
Okay.
It's cutting. What if it's anvil? It cuts this anvil in half.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely.
1 second. Tyler is showing me a video cutting an anvil in half with a 60,000 psi water jet. Now that anvil is pure metal,
yeah,
right? It's just pure
solid steel.
What's inside an anvil? So now we're looking at this water thing, and it is drilling. And it cut it. And I see, I mean, they cut it through. They cut through.
Through with a plasma cutter.
Wow. I mean, it had it. Right. That water is being projected onto the anvil, kind of like a laser beam. I mean, that's how it looked. And that's water. And it was just going to work on the anvil. That was pretty impressive.
Internally, they a lot of times they use air bubbles, too.
Barry says they also internally use air bubbles.
In the water
to be able to further increase pressure. Well, there's a lot of stuff I don't know about these things. Thank you very much for that video. That's fascinating.
You can't even smack at it.
Right.
Like when they operate it, you have to stand so far back because if you accidentally do that, it'll slice your hand off.
Of course, absolutely. I mean, if it's cutting through an anvil, it's going to cut through flesh and bone. So over here, though, what did they have 3,000 years ago? They didn't have that water pressure, but they did have a shamir. They did have the great worm. Let's go ahead and see a little bit about this worm. Now I can shine. We're beyond numbers now. Now, for a moment, there's a respite. I can now go ahead and we can have a little fun and look at the shamir. Take a look. Okay? The shamir worm cuts through stones. Says Rashi, exactly as it came from there, they set it into the wall of the structure. So they did all the major heavy lifting and cutting, according to this, in or at the quarry with this shamir thing, this worm. So exactly as it came from the quarry, they set it into the wall of the structure, and they did not chisel it further with any metal tools, because they're not allowed to by the biblical prescription. And the hewn stones, which are mentioned above in chapter 5, verse 31, which we saw a few weeks back, let's just see it again. The king commanded, and they quarried great stones, heavy stones to lay the foundation of the house with hewn stone. Okay, that's the verse, chapter 5, verse 31. So the hewn stones, which are mentioned above in chapter 5, verse 31, indicating that the stones were cut to some degree, is a controversy discussed in Sota, page 48b. And if I'm not mistaken, we did that a few weeks back. Now, we continue. The shamir was the size of a barley corn. Does anybody know how big a barley corn is? I get the impression it's small. Okay, this worm was not a massive worm. It was a small worm, but there were those who loved it. And that's, of course, a little paraphrase of, that's more than a paraphrase, of Daniel Webster in his peroration in the Dartmouth College case. Sir, it is a small school, but there are those who love it. The shamir was a small worm, but there were those who loved it. It was kept in a hollow lead pipe, filled with rags and bran flour. So we are told in this footnote in Judaica Press, this remarkable worm was powerful enough to split an entire mountain range in half. It was last used by Moses to cut the stones of the ephod in the Mishkan, as well as the first and second tablets of the law. A shamir did it. Wait a second. Didn't the Almighty God do it? Am I crazy? Isn't there a midrash that says that God personally inscribed the first tablets, the first luchos, and that they miraculously hung in midair, and you could read it from one, if you where Barry is sitting, over there, you show him the tablets, and I'm in back of the tablets over here, and I can read them too. And they're like, I can read them right to left, and they make sense, and Barry reads them right to left, and they make sense. And I thought that that was a big miracle. Didn't God do it? Now, is the shamir doing that? What's going on? Yeah. Mrs. Brolof, am I misreading it?
Right.
I am misreading it.
Go ahead.
I'm glad I'm learning.
Now, Shem engraved it, but it's talking about cutting the stone.
Cutting the stone itself.
That he had to bring up.
Thank you.
Okay.
See, I was completely, thank you. Yes, we needed a shamir in order to cut the stone. Then the Almighty engraved it. But the shamir did the cutting of the rock of the stone. Thank you. Okay, it was brought to Shlomo by an eagle from the Garden of Eden. And the Radak is a source of these. And he's citing Sota 48b and Gittin 68a and the Mezra Shocher Tov. And the Midrash Shocher Tov. So you have two Talmudical sources and a Midrashic source for all that good stuff. That is a most remarkable little worm. To be able to do all that kind of cutting is really something else. Yes. Rabbi, what do you have for me?
Yes,
want to throw some cold water on this?
The Gemara is already Radak. Look how he introduces the subject. For Yesh Merabosenu Zichorom Levracha Shayom Shayomru Ki Avra Harlop Sotum He has to be contextualized that there is such a midrashic opinion, but it seems that there are docs, shot understanding that before it came to the Makom HaMikdash, there was no prohibition against using normal metal implements. For
and so therefore they could have used all the metal they needed at the quarry.
Right.
And... but he is not sure, he's not throwing cold water on the shamir itself. No. He's admitting that there is, I mean, what was being used for the miraculous, whatever was necessary at the time of the, in the temple itself, there was a shamir, right?
He's equivocating. He is a little bit, it strains his credulity, whatever the word is.
So
he brings it out, the age where I was saying, and after he quotes the whole thing in the details, Kabbalah, Kabbalah meaning tradition, we can't, have second thoughts, we can't be skeptical, we can't put it down. But the fact is that he doesn't present it as fact, he presents it as an opinion that some of the rabbis have. So one has to understand what the Radak is really doing,
He's a classic rationalist. And he's up against a most amazing worm. And he's dealing with it as best as he can. Thank you, Rabbi Briller, for the reading on that Radak.
So, this worm.
Yeah.
There's two theories on the worm that we've got so far. The theory that this worm comes up out of the ocean, and the other one that the eagle brings the worm. So why does this worm come from the ground like most worms do? Why is it an aerial worm or a sea worm?
Tyler wants to know what the origin of the worm is. Does it come from the sea? Does it come from the ground? It's being brought to Solomon by an eagle from the Garden of Eden. That is the most amazing, Shamir. There's a Garden of Eden. And that existed in Solomon's time. There was the Gan Eden, and that the eagle went there, found the Shamir, and brought it to Shlomo Melech. It really is amazing, and it's great. I don't know how to answer your questions, Tyler. I wish I had a better answer than I'm not sure. But I always like to say the Nati Horowitz story about an Israeli physician who's Rosh Hashiva said that Yitzchak had a twin sister, and if that's the case, if Yitzchak Avinu was born with a twin sister, then why did Abraham feel the need to send Eliezer and everybody else who went on that trek all the way to the family in order to retrieve a young lady who was going to turn out to be Rivka? Why the need to find a Rivka? Just stay where you are. He already has a twin sister in China. This is prima tantora. And who is marrying the Shvatim? Didn't the Shvatim have their own sisters? So Rebrelev is on to it. So the Rosh Hashiva says, it's because Yitzchak wanted to marry a woman, not a midrash.
No.
Okay. But I'll be here all week. There are midrashim. And this is make of it what you will.
I'm confused. What do you mean you want to marry a woman out of midrash? What do you mean by marry a midrash?
that was the Rosh Hashiva's little quip. They're a midrashim. And, there's also a world of reality. And he wanted to marry a woman and not a midrash.
Okay, can I give you a similar thing? This is brought out in the book, two volumes of conversations with one of the greatest Gedolei Hador, last generation, Poskim and Gedolim, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach. The Maras HaMachpelah, right, the cave, the double cave. So some say that because it's called that, there was four couples that were traditionally buried there. And they're right, Adam and Eve, and these are the others, right, Yaakov with Leah. Okay, so and today you can go to four of the tombs, right, within the Maras. If the Jews are allowed that day, to each of the...
I remember seeing Adam and Eve personally.
Apparently there is a place there that's marked for them, apparently. Because according to this incident that happened, someone was, driving, Orbach there, and he spent time at each of the others, at each of the three for the others, and he was ready, he said he's ready to leave. And I said, what about, do you want to go to the one for Adam and Chava? And he said, that's a midrash.
Really? That's a midrash.
People with ready red belly know at some level that these things do not have the same status as things that are part of our core beliefs or a part of our definite history. They're marginalized in a different category and whatever that is. But one has to keep things in context with the whole thing.
Thank you. I myself, when I went to the Maras HaMachpelah, I don't remember seeing anything other than markers for Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and their spouses. I do not remember seeing markers for Adam and Eve. I just don't see. I didn't see it. And I would have. I don't know where I would have gone. The Muslims only allow the Jews in this particular area and whatever. But I don't remember anybody saying, hey, did you go to Adam and Eve also? And nobody said that. I don't remember anybody pointing it out. It wasn't clear that they were there. So that's fascinating. So thank you very much for that. I did not ever hear that from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. That's really very, very fascinating. Bigger shikar from that.
I'm still kind of like, I'm in this like fog here because he's saying, no, it's a midrash. Like, what do you mean by no, it's a midrash? Is this like a fantasy or like
it's
a
possible fantasy? It's in the borderline between fantasy and if there's some spiritual truth in the way I understand things, it's not the form of Hirschfeld, who was to be one of the greatest rabbis who ever lived. And he points out the difference between what he calls Shemaitza and Agaritas. Shemaitza means to have traditions, and the halakhic traditions that one has to accept, because it means Shemaitza is what we heard, what we received in terms of tradition going all the way back, if it's based on a Torah a source. And those are part of the core ideas that every believing Jew needs to believe, or else he risks being a heretic. Masha Enke, which is not the case of Agarata, the non-alachic things. Agarata means things that are spoken, things that are narrated. He said they express the opinion of the person who says them. You know, Rabbi tells us that this, that, perhaps that rabbi had a tradition, another rabbi didn't have that tradition, perhaps he was trying to give an allegory. We don't know. We work with them, but they don't have in any remote way the same degree of authenticity and in other words, that one has to, you know, believe in them or else, very specifically or very certainly literally in the sense that one has to believe that when it says that you shall tie the words of the Torah on your arms and frontlet between your eyes, that it means tefillin, which is something we do have to believe. It's a totally different category.
Okay. Yes, Midrashim. It's a world unto itself, Tyler. And I'm thinking I used to teach it in New York, and maybe we could open up again and offer a class teaching an intro to Midrash. It would be fascinating to see how the rabbis play with the words, bring out ideas, clash psukim, all over the biblical literature. They bring their massive knowledge to bear upon the word or the pasuk that they're dealing with. It really is quite a study. At all events, we're here in the world of the biblical text, and we're trying to make some sense out of it, so let's see if we can continue to do so. The next pasuk is pasuk ches, so we took a look at the, I'm sorry, I'm not done. We're not done with pasuk zayin. Pasuk seven, makavos v'hagarzen kol kli varzel lo nishma b'bayis b'hibonoso. There was neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron heard in the house while there was building. So let's go ahead and read that footnote. And hammers says, I think we may have said this last week, the word is umakavos. And they translate in English as hammers. It says Rashi, deluta, belashen Rusya. And it is fascinating for Rashi, who's living in the 11th century or so, 11th century man, and he's quoting down a Russian work. So let's go ahead and see what's going on, and you're going to see that Rabbi Rosenberg and his editorial staff are every bit as surprised as the rest of us. So do you want to jump in with the roll-up, or you want to...
I was fiddling with my phone before. I was looking into translation into a number of Slavic languages, including Russian. None of them had that word. But some of them had words that had some of the same letters in the same order, like a lamed, a le, and a tuh, you know, so they could have been some, a later derivative or relative of the Slavic word. However, I'm a skeptical of authenticity here because when Rashi, as far as I know, refers to some sort of a Slavic language, which he does do, he uses the term Lashon Kanaan. Uh-huh. Kanaan was used by the rabbis of old for a long time to refer to Ashkenaz to Germany. Canaan was used to refer to the Slavs.
Really?
And in fact, I am not even sure that Russian was known as at the time, during the time, as an ethnic group, meaning what it means now, until slightly later I had to check that out. It's most probably the Slavs of some sort, at some point, invited, I think, some Norsemen in to defend themselves against the enemy, and those Norsemen were probably called Rus or something like that. And so it's a very, very big question. Then, for the longest time, the heart of what was called Rusland or Russia was what was later called Ukraine. It's a very, very tricky thing, and I'm wondering if there's something anachronistic there. I'm just skeptical.
And I'm hoping we can answer right now. Mrs. Berlev and I gave each other a knowing look because we've seen the footnote. He's going to address this right now, and he's going to come on to your concerns. So let's see what he says. Deluta, a chisel, in the Russian language. So says Rashi. Writes Rabbi Rosenberg as follows, and I'll quote, "This is most unusual for Rashi to use a Russian word as an explanation, since there were few Jews in Russia during Rashi's lifetime. It is more logical to assume this was added to the text years later in Russian editions of the Nach. In some editions, this is completely omitted, and in others, it is in parentheses. The Targum also seems to disagree, rendering makavos, hammers, and hagarzen, chisels." The Russian idea is fascinating.
Well, how does that disagree?
Because deluta, a chisel. According to Rashi, oh, the word that's coming up from makavos is deluta.
Not hammers, chisel.
Rashi, Loshen Russia. So for Rashi, the word makavos is deluta. And we're being told that it means a chisel. That's what we're being told, that makavos is a chisel. But then the Targum calls makavos hammers, not chisels. He uses the term chisel for the other word, garzen. However, it goes down, Rashi not taking on Targum, it's all good by me. But the fascinating thing is that he is as troubled as you are, Rabbi Berlev, and as we all are, by Rashi coming on to a Russian word. Rashi, a French-German Jew of the 11th century, is suddenly knowledgeable about a Russian word. That is very unusual to me.
How
is chisel
linguist?
C-H-I-S-E-L. C-H-I-S-E-L, chisel.
Yeah, so that is the word.
In Russian, the word is deluta.
Deluta, yeah. Wow.
Okay. To me, it's only the case. It can only be that this is a very, very late emendation, a very, very late add-on, and they're attributing it to Rashi. That's so troubling. It's so troubling.
Rashi usually will translate it in
French and German.
French
and Aramaic. French, Ashkenaz, he'll say, and he'll give me the Targum once in a while. But where have you ever seen Rashi say, and in Russian, it's there, in Russian. Are you kidding me? Right. Russian? That simply sheds light on it?
Rashi will say Loshon Kanan
for the Slavic.
Very, very seldom, but he does that, I think, in one case.
Right, but the Loshon Russia, you got to be amazed. Right, this is unusual stuff. That term is just, I mean, from nowhere. So therefore, Rabbi Rosenberg, our editor of this series, is right on it. And he says, it is only logical to assume it was added to the text years later in Russian editions of the Nach. Okay? And then we conclude this pasuk. Let's just see. The door of the lowest chamber was on the right side of the house. And that already is verse 8. Now that, you know, I didn't write that. Can I just borrow a pen? Tell you have a pen. Anybody got a pen? Okay, if not, no problem. We'll go on if we can. We have a little bit of time. Let's take a look at Pasuk Ches. Thank you very much. Take a look at Pasuk Ches. Okay. Pasuk Ches. Pesach Hatzela Hatichona El Kesef Habayis Hayamanis. The door of the lowest chamber was on the right side of the house. Uvelulim yalu ala tichona. And with winding stairs, they went up into the middle chamber. Umenatichona, and from the middle chamber, el hashlishim, into the third. Okay, we got some steps going on. We got some winding chambers, winding staircases, apparently, is what's going on with a door over there. Let's take a look, and we'll conclude with this, but we'll do the whole footnote. The door of the lowest chamber was in the right side of the house. Targum Yonason rendered this word tichona as the lowest, not tichona, which is between the upper and lower ones, as usually translated. Aha. Take a look at the Targum, and let's see if that is Eisgehalten. 1 second. 8. Tara de Mechitzasa are Isab. Now, this is obviously not Targum Yonason. What we have over here in front of us is the Targum. The Targum, just on the Targum, but it's not Targum Yonason per se. That's a different source. So, okay, it's nice to know it, but we don't have it in front of me. I don't have it in front of me anyway. Roberto, do you have the Targum Yonason in front of you?
Yeah.
It was 8. He's saying that Targum Yonason renders the word, the word now, Pasuk, Pesach Hatzela Hatichona, he's translating that as the lowest.
Tara, Mugitisa, or Isa. I don't know what that means. Because of the words. Tichona,
Tara, Zimachit, Sasa.
Ara from Ara. Ara means
right.
Ground.
Ground.
Earth. So maybe the one, the ground left one, yeah.
Okay.
It's a standard Targum.
Okay. Tara de Mechitzasa, Arisa. He translates the word Tichona as the lowest. Arisa, of the ground level.
I have
a Targum. I thought it was a different... Right. I thought it was a different... Because when I was preparing the shiur on Esav Slashem, there was Targum Yonason and Targum Ben Uziel.
Yonason
Ben Uziel, and I saw there were two different. I gotta show it to you. Yeah, I'll go take in Tehillim.
I
gotta go.
Sugum could be something different, but in Uziel, the
Targum is Targum Yonason. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. So I'm corrected. Targum, the Targum that we have here in front of us in the Judaica Press, when it says Targum, that is indeed Targum Yonason. Thank you for clarifying that, Rabbi Berloff. Mrs. Berloff, did you want to add something?
Yeah, because later in the process, Hatikona specifically is obviously in the middle, because you've got the winding stairs to the Hatikona and then Hatikona El HaShalisha.
So in the Hebrew, it would appear that the word Tichona is, as usual, understood to be in the middle. But for whatever reason, the Targum Yonason is interpreting the first usage of the word Tichona in the beginning of Pasuk 8 as the lowest level, not the middle level. That is a curiosity. Let's take a look. You'd expect it to be talking about the lowest level, then the middle.
Yeah.
Okay. Right, but still, we've always been looking at the word Tichona as meaning the middle. Jonathan renders this word Tichona as the lowest, the ground level, not Tichona, which is between the upper and lower ones, as usually translated. That's what he's reading over here. Now, Rashi, because the five chambers on the southern side, had one opening to the outside, which was in the lowest story. And this second usage of the word Tichona in this same verse, quote, and with winding stairs, they went up into the middle Tichona chamber. There, Targum Yonason renders Tichona the middle, because these chambers were not opened to the outside, but only to the other chambers. So for Targum Yonason, the word Tichona is going to mean lowest level at the beginning of the pasuk and mid-level in the middle of the pasuk. The caption Tichona should be omitted. This is a parenthesis. The caption Tichona should be omitted since it interferes with the explanation begun at the close of the previous Rashi, which in reality is one continuous verse. There were three openings. This is Rashi continuing. There were three openings to each of the chambers. I'll just read through. There were three openings to each of the chambers. Thus it is taught in Tractate Midos, Chapter 4, Mishnah 3. Quote, one was to the chamber on the right, one was to the chamber on the left, and one to the chamber above. And the prophet teaches us here that only one of the lower chambers on the southern side had an opening to the outside. And only through that opening can we enter all of the chambers on all sides. And the, quote, middle chamber of the verse, Hatzela Hatichona, is not the middle one between the upper and the lower, but the middle one of the five chambers on the southern side, which had an opening to the outside in the lowest story. And this is the meaning of, quote, and with winding stairs they went up ala tichona into the middle chamber. That's our language here in our pasuk. And with winding stairs they went up into the middle chamber, and from the middle into the third. And so Rashi says, the middle chamber of the verse is not the middle one between the upper and lower, but rather the middle of the five on the southern side. That's the meaning of, quote, the words, and with winding stairs they went up al hatichona into the middle chamber, which was above it, signifying that Tzela hatichona was below. So says Rashi. Kind of confusing people. With winding stairs, Targum Yonason rendered the word lul, and that is our word uvelulim in the Hebrew. Jonathan rendered the word lul, a winding staircase, and that is called in our language, this is again Rashi, vis, Old French, and in German, Windelstein. Got to see that in the Hebrew, if I can. That is fascinating.
It's
too
German.
Jacob Jonasson.
I suspect that the first one is authentic and the second one is a later one.
Uh-huh.
Looking at Windelstein.
Sounds later.
I think that's probably the early one. Right. But it's not the Rashi. Because look what it says to teach. The Shema Murgo and the word that we usually use, the regular word in German, is Spindelstein.
Spindelstein.
I suspect that that she may have been in bad transmission of Rashi's German, may have been Spindel to begin with, and somehow the sin disappeared in transmission from people who didn't know German.
Mm-hmm.
Later, when they did speak German or Yiddish, came Spindel, and Steve, out of time, may have started, what does it mean in English?
And that is a structure of stone pillars made in the form of stairs.
So Stein or Steg in German means a step.
Mm-hmm.
So
Steger, right.
Stein could be a stone that could be two.
Thank you.
So I'm not sure. That's my guess, is that the first one looks
love
like
seeing,
really Rashi,
uh-huh,
and the second one is some later guy.
Right. So the first one you're saying,
Windelstein
right, is Rashi Mistala.
Right, or at least what came down as a Mistala from the Rashi.
Thank you.
Transcription, yeah.
Very good. And thank you. And that's a structure, Windelstein, that's a structure of stone pillars made in the form of stairs. And he who goes on them is likened to one spiraling around a column and ascending on it several cubits high without inclining the steps, as would be necessary by an ordinary ladder, because its spiral serves as its incline. We've all seen that. We've all seen these extremely tight spiral staircases where they don't have a whole lot of area taking up, but you still get where you need to go by walking very tightly around the spiral. I'm sorry? Right. You have something like that too. Right, exactly.
Is there a relationship between this and Jacob's ladder?
I wouldn't know about that. They don't seem to be making any kind of, I don't see any kind of, any overt reference to it. They're just talking about a spiraling staircase, apparently, because always useful when you don't have a whole lot of area, a lot of space, you use a spiraling staircase. I'm not sure if there's any reference to the Jacobian ladder. But we will finish off over here with the very last part of the footnote. Thank you, Tyler. Into the third, El HaShlishim. And from the middle into the third, the word Shlishim is translated as though it were spelled with an extra yud, Shlishiyim, to denote the ordinal number, the third. So it went from the Tichona, El HaShlishiyim, is how we translate. It's as if it's got an extra yud in over there, according to Rashi. And Sidi Ibn Ezra, he says, on Genesis chapter 6, verse 16. Okay, so we've seen a little bit of everything. And is this the origin of the phrase that we should steige weg? We should go from level to level using a staircase, so to speak. Is that not the term that we use, that we should steige in our studying? I always thought it meant, concentrate more. But I guess it means move up and up and up, just like a Windelstein or a Schwindelstieg. You should be steiging and steiging away as you learn Torah. Hopefully we did a little bit of steiging and steiging tonight. Obviously it's a little bit difficult without actually seeing depictions and pictures. Tough to see and imagine how the first temple looked. If anybody has any sort of depiction of it, please let us know and we'll try to utilize it. And in all events, I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight. Wishing everybody a really good week and a good Shabbos. Enjoy the 4th of July, hopefully in cool weather. Enjoy your barbecues. And I wish to thank the Almighty for the opportunity to live in a country which enables us to study Torah and live, pray, and live lives of Jewish people. And it's a wonderful place, and we're delighted to be here. And enjoy the 4th of July. Have a very good week and a good Shabbos. All best. Bye-bye.